Good morning, and thank you, Craig, for the invitation to be able to speak today. It's a great pleasure for me to be able to be here. It's fantastic to see so many Canadians in the audience. I've been to Canada many times myself, and I know it's a long way away, and so I really appreciate the effort that so many of you have made to travel here, and I hope that you're finding it worthwhile. The original plan for this session was to have the Bank of Canada Governor, Steve Pollas, also speak. But the timing of this session coincided with the Bank of Canada's regular blackout period ahead of its next monetary policy meeting. So, like us, the Bank of Canada has a blackout, and so Steve wasn't able to come. But I did speak to him over the weekend about my remarks, and the common element in our discussion was just how similar our experiences have been, and so I'm going to talk about some of those similarities today. The Bank of Canada and the Reserve Bank of Australia enjoy an incredibly warm relationship. Many of the issues we face are similar, and our perspectives are often very close to one another. It's partly because of the similarities in our economy, but it's also because Australians and Canadians are both pragmatic and open-minded people, and we don't take ourselves too seriously. So there's a natural warmth and affinity between us, and we see this very clearly at the level of the central banks. On the economic front, we're both medium-sized trading nations. We both are rich in natural resources. We both had to come to terms with volatile prices for our key exports. We both have strong and resilient banking systems. We both have floating exchange rates and operate flexible inflation targets. We're both attractive places for non-residents to invest their savings, and we both have growing populations. We both had to deal with very large increases in housing prices in some of our cities. With all that in common, it's not surprising that we find much to talk about and experiences to share. As Mr. Harper said, Australia and Canada are both countries that have benefited greatly from international trade. We are both strong supporters of a rules-based open international trading system. Unfortunately, too often these days, a commitment to open international trade, integration into global capital markets, a strong role for markets, and a dynamic financial sector are seen as liabilities, not as assets, as they should be. Australia and Canada provide strong counterexamples to this. We show that openness can deliver both prosperity and resilience. We enjoy standards of living that relatively few people in the world enjoy. Now, economies have had our ups and downs, but they've also proved to be pretty resilient. Australians and Canadians also understand that the benefits from openness can fall unevenly across our communities. We recognise that while openness can make the size of the pie bigger, it can affect the distribution of the pie in a way that our societies feel uncomfortable about. And this is something that we both tried to do something about. We clearly have more work to do here, but we've also had more success on this front than many other countries. With that introduction, the main focus of my remarks this morning is on the outlook for the Australian economy, and I'd like to talk about that outlook in the context of three issues that I think will have very strong resonance with the Canadians in the audience. The first of these is the cycle investment in the resources sector. The second is developments in the housing market and household borrowing. And the third is inflation targeting in a low inflation, low interest rate environment. The Reserve Bank of Australia released our latest economic forecast a couple of weeks ago. We expect economic growth to be around 3% in the next couple of years. It's a little faster than our estimates of potential growth rate. Despite that, we don't expect much change in the unemployment rate for a while yet. It currently stands at around 5.75%. And that's because the above potential growth rate over the next couple of years is largely a result of expansion in LNG production, which doesn't employ that many people. Over the next couple of years, the increase in LNG production is expected to add around 0.5% to our annual growth rate. So it's a significant effect. Given this outlook, we expect underlying inflation to increase, but to do so only gradually. Wage growth remains subdued, but it's not expected to decline further, and spare capacity is likely to remain in the economy for some time yet. So our central forecast for headline is for headline inflation to increase to above 2% later this year, boosted by increases in oil and tobacco prices, and the increase in underlying inflation is expected to be a bit more gradual than that. The first of the three issues shaping the forecast that I expect will strike a resonance with the Canadians in the audience is the shifting commodity prices and investment in the resources sector. This has been a really important factor in both of our countries, and the general stories are similar, but the details are different, and I have some pictures here, which I hope will show that. One area where you can see this difference is the size in the movement in the terms of trade. In the first decade of this century, Australia's terms of trade doubled. In 2011, they reached their highest level since the gold rushes of the 1850s. So for us, it was quite a boom. So Canada's terms of trade also rose, and the rise was large in a historical context. The lows you can see here, it's not on the same dimension as what occurred here. This difference in magnitude of the rise in the terms of trade reflects two factors. The first is that the prices of Australia's main commodity exports, their iron ore and coal, increased much more significantly than the price of Canada's main commodity export, that's oil. It's because the short-run supply curve for iron ore and coal tends to be very steep, so when demand for these steel-making commodities increased because of Chinese investment in property and infrastructure rose very strongly, the prices also rose strongly. And the second factor explaining the bigger rise in Australia's terms of trade is that commodities make up a significantly larger share of Australia's exports than is the case for Canada. On the back of these higher prices, both of our countries have experienced a pronounced cycle in mining investment, not surprisingly, given the bigger movement in commodity prices for Australia's exports. The cycle investment's been larger here than it has been in Canada. And you can see this in the left-hand panel of this chart. Mining investment in Australia went from 2 or 3% of GDP in the early 2000s to 9% in 2012. You can see the same pattern in Canada, although it's not as pronounced. Another difference with Canada here is that our main export partner, China, has grown at an average rate of almost 10% over this period, whereas Canada's main export partner, the United States, has grown by just 2%, so it's quite a difference. Importantly, both our countries have accommodated this big increase in mining investment without overheating, and our flexible exchange rates have been key to this. Given the larger cycle in mining investment in Australia, the impact on the rest of our economy has perhaps been a bit more pronounced than has been the case in Canada. While many parts of our economy did very well from the boom in mining investment, others didn't, as they had to deal with the higher exchange rate and they found it difficult and more expensive to hire workers. And one illustration of this broad impact on the rest of the economy of the mining boom in Australia can be seen in the decline in non-mining investment as a share of GDP. You can see that on the left-hand side of that chart. By way of contrast, Canadian non-mining investment has shown much less variation than has been the case in Australia. For some time, a major factor shaping our forecasts for the Australian economy has been a rebalancing of investment between the resources and the non-resource sectors. We estimate that the decline in mining investment back to around normal levels is around 90% done now, and you can see that in that chart. So this headwind of declining mining investment, which has been weighing on GDP growth in Australia for a few years now, is about to blow itself out before too long. Another headwind that we've had for some years is the fall in commodity prices. But since the middle of last year, this has turned into a gentle tailwind. Since then, the prices of all our main commodity exports have risen. This is clearly good news for us, although we're not expecting the higher prices to lead to the type of pickup in investment in the resources sector that might once have occurred. That's because we've already had such a huge expansion in supply capacity, and we do expect some unwinding of the recent increases in commodity prices. but the higher prices are providing an important boost to our national income at the moment, and this is expected to have some flow-through effects to the rest of the economy. The other part of the story shaping the outlook is an expected pickup in non-mining business investment. And this pickup has been a very long time coming. As in Canada, the picture is complicated by the significant differences across the regions. As I hope you can see in this next chart, in those parts of Australia where mining investment's been declining, that's in Western Australia and Queensland, non-mining investment has also been falling because of the spillover effects from the decline in the resources sector. Elsewhere, though, the picture's much more encouraging. Non-mining business investment's now picked up significantly in Victoria and New South Wales, and the survey measures of current business conditions have also increased, and so too have broad measures of capacity utilisation. And these are positive developments. The pickup in non-mining business investment now seems to be starting, expected to be subdued for a while yet, but as we go through the next few years, we expect a reasonable rise in non-mining business investment now. I'd now like to turn to the second issue that I hope will strike a resonance with the Canadians in the audience, that's housing prices and borrowing. This is an issue that's discussed a lot in both of our countries. You know, we both had strong housing markets over recent years, and there are concerns about the level of household debt. When we've looked at the experience, there seem to be quite a lot of similarities in the underlying factors. One is population growth. For advanced industrial economies, we've both been experiencing pretty strong population growth over recent times. In Australia, population growth has averaged 1.7% over the past decade. In Canada, it's a bit over 1%. As you can see, in the last couple of years, the difference here has narrowed. Another similarity is that there's been very strong demand from overseas residents for investments in residential property, particularly in our wonderful Pacific Rim cities. Not only are these cities attractive places to live, but Australia and Canada also offer investors security of property rights and both economic and financial stability. Given this strong demand and its impact on prices in some areas, some state and provincial governments have recently levied additional taxes on foreign investors, and that is having some effect. In both countries, though, nationwide measures of housing prices have been increasing quite quickly. You can see that here. Our housing markets have also been affected by the global monetary environment. We both run independent monetary policies, but the level of interest rates in our countries is influenced by what happens elsewhere in the world. With interest rates so low and our economies being resilient, it's not really surprising that people have found it an attractive time to borrow money and to buy housing. The result is higher prices. Another characteristic that we have in common is that at the time of strong demand from both residents and non-residents for residential property, there are challenges on the supply side of the market. I understand that zoning is an issue in Canada, just as it is in Australia. In some parts of Australia, there's also been underinvestment in transport infrastructure, which has limited the supply of well-located land just at the time that the demand for such land has been growing strongly. Again, the result is higher prices. We're also experiencing large differences across the various submarkets within our countries, and you can see that here. We both have had very strong housing markets in our major cities, but there's been weakness in the mining-related regions following the end of the mining investment boom. So in many ways, the pictures are very similar. The increase in overall housing prices in both of our countries has gone hand in hand with a further pickup in household debt. In both countries, the ratio of household debt to income is at a record high, although the low level of interest rates means that the debt servicing burdens aren't particularly high at the moment. In Australia, the household sector is coping reasonably well with the high levels of debt, but there are now signs that the debt levels are affecting household spending. In aggregate, households are carrying more debt than they have before, and at the same time they're experiencing slower growth in their nominal incomes than they have for some decades. And for many households, this is proving to be a sobering combination. Reflecting this in our latest forecasts, were prepared on the basis that growth in consumption was unlikely to run ahead of growth in income over the coming years. In other words, the household saving rate was likely to be steady for a while. As you can see, that's a slightly different picture from that over recent years, where the saving rate in Australia has been gradually declining. This interaction between consumption, saving and borrowing for households is a very significant issue, and I know that's one that both of our central banks are watching very carefully. It's one of the key uncertainties around our central outlook for the Australian economy. It's also cited as one of the key risks to the inflation outlook in Canada in the Bank of Canada's latest monetary policy report. They had a discussion of this issue. You know, we're still learning how households respond to higher levels of debt and to lower nominal income growth. As I said, for many households, it's a sobering combination. So it's useful for us at the Reserve Bank of Australia and the Bank of Canada to compare notes on this issue and to learn from one another. The final issue where there's a commonality of experience that I want to touch on is dealing with an extended period of low inflation. For a few years now, we've both experienced unusually low rates of inflation, and you can see this in this final chart. Again, many of the same factors are at play. Wage growth has been weak given the ongoing slack in the labour market, and we've both seen downward pressure on retail prices from intensified competition. In its latest monetary policy report, the Bank of Canada noted that the increased competition in food retailing was affecting food prices. The same's true in Australia, but the experience here is a bit broader, where we've seen new entrants in retailing putting downward pressure on the prices of a whole range of goods and services, not just on food prices. We're both expecting inflation to increase gradually, but to do so over the next couple of years. In our case, we expect the disinflationary effects of the earlier decline in commodity prices and the competitive pressures in retailing to wane over time. Some pickup in wage growth is expected, although wage increases are likely to remain low for some time yet. Our liaison with business suggests that a pickup in wage growth is not imminent, but nor does it suggest that a further slowing in wage growth is in prospect. Over recent times, both central banks have had to think about the implications for their monetary policy frameworks of sustained low inflation and rapid increases in borrowing and housing prices. Both have recently reaffirmed that inflation targeting remains the right monetary policy framework. We've also both emphasised that our inflation targets are flexible, that they're not rigid straitjackets. In our case, the emphasis is very much on medium-term outcomes rather than the outcome in any particular period or over any horizon. So while there are kind of some subtle differences in language between the two central banks, there is a high degree of commonality in our approaches. Governor Polas has said on a number of occasions that the Bank of Canada takes a risk management approach to monetary policy. And this strikes a very strong resonance with us at the Reserve Bank of Australia. At any point in time, there are quite a few different paths that the cash rate could follow to achieve Australia's inflation target, which is to achieve an average rate of inflation over time of 2 point something. And consistent with the Reserve Bank Act, we set out to choose that path which, in our judgment, best promotes the welfare of the Australian people. In our risk management exercises, we've been seeking to balance the risk from having inflation low for a long period of time against the risks from attempting to increase inflation more quickly, which would partly come through encouraging yet more borrowing. If inflation's low for a long period of time, it's certainly possible that inflation expectations are just making it harder for us to achieve our objective. At the moment, though, I don't see a particularly high risk of this in Australia. The recent lift in headline inflation is going to be helpful here, and most measures of inflation expectations are within the range seen over recent years. In relation to the risk from additional borrowing, it is possible that continuing rises in indebtedness partly as a result of low interest rates, increase the fragility of household balance sheets? If so, then at some point in the future, households having decided that they had borrowed too much might cut back their consumption sharply, hurting the economy and employment. It's difficult to quantify this risk, but it is a risk that it's also difficult to ignore. As I said, our focus at the Reserve Bank of Australia is on the medium term, not just on the next year or so. Another consideration that's important in thinking about the risk of the trends in the labour market. All else constant, if the unemployment rate is high and rising, the stronger would be the case for policy to pursue a quicker return to inflation to the midpoint of the target. To date, though, we've been satisfied that the labour market's heading in the right direction, if not as quickly as we would like. After declining over 2015, our unemployment rate's been broadly steady for a while now, while employment growth has been concentrated in part-time jobs. Like the housing market, the labour market outcomes are varying very significantly across the country, so this too is an area that we continue to watch very carefully. In summary then, flexible inflation targeting with a strong medium-term focus remains the right monetary policy framework for us here in Australia. In both Australia and Canada, our monetary policy frameworks have played important roles in our economic stability over recent times. As I mentioned at the start of my remarks, we also share other strengths: a rich commodity base, strong and resilient banking system, an attractive destination for foreign investment, a flexible exchange rate, and a commitment to openness and competitive markets. But overall, Australia and Canada provide pretty good advertisements for a flexible inflation targeting framework. On that note, I will conclude. Thank you for your listening, and I look forward to any questions and comments. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Governor. And before we get into the question and answer session, I just wanted to put a bit of a context in today's discussion. So we've done similar events in the past, and I've had the privilege of interviewing a number of Fed officials. So we did an event with Chairman Greenspan, Chairman Bernanke, and the process is fairly typical. You submit questions, and then they get the answers, and it's a little more scripted. So in advance of this meeting, I spoke with Governor Lowe before the holidays, and I said, so do you want me to submit questions in advance? And he said, no, there's no need for that. And then I said, well, are there any questions I shouldn't ask? And he said, no, anything's fair. And then I said, are there any questions I should ask? And he said, no, whatever you want to do. So
there were no questions off limits. There were only answers that were off limits.
Yes, fair enough. So in terms of this, the era of a more open and transparent central bank, the push is on. I think you do have the gold standard here in Australia. So thank you for your comments. As listening to your presentations, a higher appreciation for the role of central bankers and the inherent balancing act and the trade-offs that take place almost on a daily basis. So Canada sees it as well, a lot of similarities between the two economies, but the trade-offs are there. You see regional divergence with the boom and bust cycle that we've seen, and monetary policy is a very blunt tool. Inflation, like many central banks, coming in lower than expected and lower than target. And yet you don't want to keep rates too low for too long or move lower in the event that it does run some risks on financial stability. So there are a lot of these trade-offs that are going on. When you look at the Australian outperformance, and I think that's one, you know, we touched on a lot of similarities between Canada and Australia, but one striking factor, I think, is that for 25 years we've not seen a recession in Australia, which Canada would love to have that experience. Some areas you mentioned, in terms of trade, higher price movements there, but also a relatively higher weight in that sector. How much of a role do you think the different target inflation targeting regime, I mean, we have in Canada this risk management quasi-flexible inflation target, but it is still 2% target, whereas yours is a little more flexible with 2 to 3 over the cycle. And was that not a factor in terms of navigating through this boom-bust cycle in commodities and one of the components for this outperformance of Australia?
No, I don't think it's very much. The differences are very stark in reality. We choose different language. The language that I choose really is about medium-term outcomes rather than kind of the inflation outcomes over a particular horizon. And it's more of an issue of semantics than actual practice.
Okay. And the when we look around the globe, and you had suggested global monetary policies, we've never seen so many central banks so accommodative for such a long period of time. We now have something close to 25% of the global economy operating with negative overnight interest rates. Australia at a record low, Canada almost at a record low, just off the record low. How, moving forward, as we see an eventual normalization, whatever that means in terms of the terminal point for interest rates, how much of a factor do you take into account other central bank movements, given that the transition, like Canada, is going to rely in part on acceleration exports, and a stronger currency may not be as helpful in that environment?
Well, what's going on around the world is obviously very important to both us and to Canada. And now, the central banks get the blame for the very low interest rates, and I can understand why that's the case. But there is something they're not just doing that in a vacuum. The reason that central banks have low interest rates is that in recent years there's been an elevated appetite to save. Governments have tried to repair their balance sheets, and households are trying to do that. So a lot of people want to save, and the business community hasn't really wanted to do much capital formation. So there hasn't been much demand for the world's savings, and there's been an increase in the world's savings. And when that happens, savers get lower rates of return. And the way our financial systems work is that that gets delivered through the actions of the central banks. So I've said a number of times recently, I think we should welcome a gradual rise in interest rates in the world, because it would mean that the acute appetite to save would be diminishing, but more importantly, that the return to underlying capital formation is higher, and businesses are prepared to use the world's savings to increased capital formation and stronger growth, and that's something that we should be welcoming. So the central banks are kind of get the blame, but they're really responding to these underlying forces about saving investment in the world, and because ultimately there's a very big influence from global factors on all our interest rate setting decisions. In, I don't know whether this happens in Canada, but there's always incredible scrutiny on our decision from month to month, but we're really responding to much bigger global forces in the world.
Right. You mentioned the savings side of it. Of course, part of that is the demographics that many advanced economies are facing with the aging demographics. It also has an impact on the speed limit for the economy, so the potential speed limit, which is what I think many in Prime Minister Hubbard mentioned, that people are adjusting down to this new normal, secular stagnation. There's a number of terms for it. I think the IMF refers to the new mediocre. So that is all a slower speed limit. And the role of central banks in that environment is, I think that's more about economic policy and fiscal policy, but what is the role of central bank in terms of adjusting to this lower speed limit?
Well, I don't accept the proposition that we have to have lower growth. I mean, it's certainly possible, but by nature I'm more optimistic. I look at the technological changes that are occurring in the world right now, and the kind of the way the tools of science are progressing, and the options that the possibilities that raises for, you know, my children's generation, the rate of technological progress, and we're still coming to grips with how to harness that. It's a bit like, you know, when electricity was first developed, it took decades to work out how to use it, and then it transformed the society. I'm optimistic that the technological changes that are taking place now will transform our society in ways that I can't imagine over the next two decades. The issue isn't, I don't think, slower growth. It's really, as Mr. Harper referred to, I think it's more the distribution of that growth, because technology and trade create very strong returns to a part of the population that benefits, you know, it increases the returns to the winners, but it increases the size of the pie, but increases the return to the winners as well. And our societies are struggling with how to kind of do that, to make sure that we have the incentives for technology and for trade, which will increase the size of the pie, but at the same time deal with the distribution issues. And really, the central bank has very little role in this. All our role is, in the end, to set the overnight interest rate, which is when we're responding really to the global balance of saving and investment. So if the more optimistic interpretation is correct, then sometime in my seven-year term, business will get its kind of mojo back globally and say, yep, we can find fantastic opportunities to invest, and then interest rates Yeah. Well, whereas I hope that's what happens.
As do I. I think the recent minutes from your last meeting suggest a little more favorable turn to global environment and global growth prospects look a little less worrisome. We've seen commodity prices, oil prices, and inflation generally start to move higher after the risk being largely to downside inflation expectations. So hopefully that's a trend that does continue as we go forward. Now, are there any questions from the delegates? Do anybody have a question for the governor while we have him here? Thank you. Oh, up front, please.
Governor Michael, Statutory Financial Review. Just a couple of quick related questions. The International Monetary Fund has called on the Reserve Bank to keep rates lower for longer to avoid some sort of low inflation trap that you've referred to there. But are you concerned that lower for longer would pose a bigger risk to financial stability? That's the first question. And related to that, the tension showed in that the Reserve Bank seems to be fueling house prices with very low rates, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, but the prudential regulator is trying to hose it down at the same time with lending controls. And how much a factor in this tension do you think are tax arrangements, such as the interaction of negative gearing and the discount for capital gains tax for property investors?
Well, thank you. There are a lot of issues there. What I've learned in my job is I get lots of advice from lots of quarters. I think that, as I tried to discuss in my remarks, that we are trying to balance multiple objectives at the moment. We'd like the economy to grow a bit more quickly, and we'd like the unemployment rate to come down a bit more quickly than is currently forecast. But if we were to try and achieve that through monetary policy, it would encourage people to borrow more money, and it probably would put more upward pressure on housing prices. And at the moment, I don't think either of those two things are really in the national interest. So, you know, it is a consideration, and we are balancing that. At the moment, as Craig was kind of as alluding to, I think there are signs that things are improving in the economy, seen in a whole range of business indicators in the last couple of months. So the hope is that the current setting of monetary policy will generate stronger growth, and we can avoid a further upward pressure on housing prices. So it is an issue.
There was a question right here. Thank you.
Thanks, Governor. Tim Harcourt from the University of New South Wales and host of the Airport Economist on Qantas. I was trying to put together Prime Minister Harper's presentation and yours. And Prime Minister Harper mentioned that whilst Australia and Canada had broadly got things right in terms of free trade deals and having an open economy, there was a paradox where there had been declines in working class and middle class incomes in the West. As a central bank governor in the 70s or 80s, you would have been worried about the real wage overhang and wages moving, growing too fast. As a central bank governor today, you've mentioned about wage growth being too low and not being able to grow incomes enough in the economy. When you think back to the trade and labour market reforms, do you think that whilst Canada and Australia did the right things in terms of opening up to free trade and having very open markets, that in terms of the labour market, we either went too far with deregulation, didn't go far enough, or we did the wrong kind of deregulation, and that is one of the things that the US is trying to grapple with the growth of the Trump support against protection rather than looking at issues in the labour market?
We've benefited from a flexible labour market over recent years. If you know, when we had resources boom in the past, wage growth would accelerate very quickly, the economy would overheat, monetary policy would have to be tightened, and then kind of a recession would follow. That was the pattern that we had. I don't know whether that was the pattern in Canada. In the most recent resources boom, that didn't happen. Wage growth picked up in certain parts of the country, particularly in Western Australia, in the kind of the mining areas. It didn't flow through to the rest of the economy. The wage acceleration didn't derail the expansion, and it's one reason why now in the downturn that we're able to manage this without having very weak growth. So the flexibility we have in our labour market has served us as really well. I don't see labour market deregulation as a factor that's led to the low outcomes over the last couple of years. We're adjusting to a big decline in our national income. The system's operating really, as the textbook would suggest, slower wage growth. I also think that many workers in Western industrialised countries feel a bit shell-shocked. They worry about international competition. Service sector workers in Sydney, which once upon a time would have felt pretty immune from the forces of global competition, now see potential competition from China and India and the services that can be done globally. And so we all feel like there's a few more competitors out there. And so most people don't really like that. But in the end, it's good for us because it makes us just kind of strive harder. And I see the Australian businesses, and I'm sure the same is true in Canada, I see Australian businesses responding to this competition. Even in Australian manufacturing right at the moment, there's an improvement going on because the firms that are able to survive with the high exchange rate are kind of leaner and more efficient. And so this competition we're all feeling is kind of making us do things a bit better, but, we don't like it. And I think it's kind of at the heart of some of the unease that Mr. Harper talked about. And when we feel like there's a lot of competition, we don't really put our hand up and say, can I have a bigger wage rise, please? Say, well, I'm happy to keep my job. And my hope is that gradually this will lift as the economy continues to grow at a reasonable pace, the unemployment rate drifts down, that wage growth will lift. Now, for most of my career, as the central bank, we were always worrying that wage growth might be a bit too fast. At the moment, we're worrying that it's a bit too low and that a slight pickup in wage growth would certainly help us meet our inflation target. I think it would help people, the community, feel a bit better as well.
It was a similar issue in Canada. I think that the cycle, the preferences, workers look for job security rather than wage gains, and then structural, this global competition for the best and brightest.
I don't think we've kind of permanently lost the desire to put our hand up and ask for a larger wage rise. That's not the Australian way, but I think temporarily, because of global competition and technology, we're just a bit reluctant to do that, and I hope that will pass.
And it helped with the consumer side, right, that are getting squeezed in real incomes.
It would make people feel better, yeah. even if it's not stronger real wages. I think kind of stronger growth in nominal wages would help people feel better, and it would help with the debt situation as well.
Nancy Southern from ATCO here in Australia and Canada. Just wondered if you might be able to comment on if anti-globalization takes hold, as Mr. Harper pointed out, that there may be a very serious trend towards that. And if the surplus capacity in the world, both from a commodity perspective and a monetary perspective, the surplus cash in the market is starting to get absorbed, and then if governments start to take on a far more stringent fiscal policy to reduce deficits, do you think that the monetary policy will be able to keep up with a seismic type of shift that perhaps is starting to occur?
There are a lot of ifs there. If we retreat from globalization and we have fiscal consolidation, so I don't know what that world looks like. This is a point that I've kind of been repeating a lot lately. Monetary policy can't solve every problem. we can't turn, at the central bank, we can't turn kind of an okay outlook into kind of a fantastic outlook. We can hopefully stop something kind of bad in the economy, but we can't turn good into really, really good or excellent. Business and the political class can do that. So the world that you're painting is probably one where the political class is kind of moving away from good to something not so good. If that's what happens, you can't expect the central banks to reverse all that and kind of make things all fine again. We can do so much. We can mitigate financial stresses. We can smooth out the business cycle. We can deliver on our inflation target. But we can't lift sustainably the growth rate if the political class and businesses are taking actions that lower potential growth. That's the reality. And I fear sometimes that the community expects too much of the central bank to be able to turn good into to really good again. And you, the people in this room can do that. I can't do that. My colleagues and I can't do that at the central bank. You can, though.
How about you? Please.
Bob Onuschuk, CEO of the Forum. Thank you for being here, Governor. Governor, you've got a tremendous amount of infrastructure being developed. I mean, your cities, this city has got a building boom second to none. Well, the same as Toronto, but and you've got a ton of projects and a pipeline in the infrastructure space that just goes, is mind-boggling for Canadians. But so I wanted to ask you, how do you see that playing out in relation to the Australian economy? What is the prognostication? How will it help? And the subsequent question is, in terms of the private sector companies that have not been spending, at least in the Canadian and the North American economy, monies on new CapEx, what is the situation here, and is that an issue, or where do you see that going?
Yeah. There are a number of important issues there on infrastructure investment. We're doing a lot, and well, perhaps when you walked outside the hotel, you saw some of it, but you know, there's scope to do more. You know, I think particularly in transportation infrastructure, because our population's been growing quickly, but we have not built enough transportation infrastructure to deal with that, and now we're having issues with the supply of electricity as well. I think the underinvestment in transportation infrastructure is particularly problematic, because with the growing population, it means our cities are becoming more and more crowded, people are getting frustrated, they partly blame the immigrants, and so it's insidious. So it's very good news that in New South Wales we're investing in transportation infrastructure. I think there's capacity to do that around the country as well. It helps competition, it helps people move around, it makes people's lives better. And it would also provide a boost to aggregate demand in the economy at the moment. So I go through the type of things that infrastructure investment could do for kind of increased supply, increased demand, make people's lives better, address housing affordability. It's like tick, tick, tick all the way down. And the issue is, why can't we do even more? Because there is plenty of money out there, and I often talk to the Canadian pension funds, and they say what a fantastic place this is to invest in infrastructure. They just want more projects. And so the challenge for us is to design the projects, to get the governance right, to make sure that the projects that are selected have a strong business case, the construction costs are well managed, the pricing of the infrastructure is appropriate, to do the governance right. And that's difficult for us it's difficult for anyone in any political system. So there's plenty of money out there, but I think we could do ourselves a service by having more infrastructure investment in this country, building the assets that our growing economy needs. More broadly in business investment, it has been weak for a long period of time, and the big forecasting revisions we keep making at the central bank are really to private business investment. We keep on expecting it to pick up, and it keeps on disappointing. For the first time in quite a few years now, we're seeing that cycle turn, which if that continues, that's good. I think for quite a few years, many businesses have felt a bit like workers. They haven't really wanted to kind of spend because they feel a lot of uncertainty about technology, about China, the political system, the strength of demand with households struggling with high levels of debt. So there are a lot of the corporate boardrooms that I go to, there's a lot of kind of, well, there's this uncertainty, there's this uncertainty. And I think when you're uncertain, it's a good reason to delay. Well, I'll just wait another few months and see if these uncertainties resolve. And what tends to happen is one uncertainty gets resolved, another one comes along. And so there's always a reason for delay. I'm hopeful that we're now on the cusp of that turning because the global environment seems to have picked up. Business confidence in Australia has risen a bit. And I hope those businesses that have been delaying because of the uncertainties, and now a few more of them are starting to say, well, okay, now's the time to commit some capital spending. And you see that in New South Wales and Victoria. And if that were to happen more broadly, it could change the dynamics quite a lot, because we need to do more capital formation in this country.
Derek. There's a mic coming to you right there.
Thank you very much. I want to try to tempt you just a little wee bit into the political terrain that you've been skillfully avoiding so far. If you accept Stephen Harper's premise about the futility of deficit spending as an instrument for growth, if you accept that premise, then do you see as part of the role of the central bank governor to provide some cautionary advice to governments that tend to overindulge in that area, or is this beyond your purview?
It's beyond my purview to provide advice, but I do feel it's my what I can do is be analytical. And a point that I've made repeatedly, and the previous governor made this point as well, is that we should back to infrastructure. We should think of infrastructure, or infrastructure has the potential to all these positive things I talked about before. And we shouldn't be afraid to borrow for infrastructure, particularly where there's a strong business case. So, kind of when you think about this, kind of a circle back to the deficit issue, we should be very careful about how we think about deficits. It's, you know, financing current expenditure from debt is problematic. Building assets with debt is not problematic if you address the things I was talking about before: governance and project selection and pricing. So I think that's kind of the analytical point. Recurrent and spending and taxation need to be in balance, and we should be able to borrow to build assets, because our country needs more assets. It needs business to invest in new assets, and it needs governments to facilitate investment in assets. And it may not need to borrow that much money. It may need to facilitate some of the people in this room to create the new assets. So that's the analytical point. Proper kind of business budgeting, as a business would do. You know, if you said to a business you can never borrow, the business would never grow. But if you said to a business you can finance yourself your kind of operating budget year after year with debt, business would go eventually out there. So it's kind of a subtlety in the argument. That's the role that I think the central bank can play, not providing political advice, but pointing out some...
You might share at least that much with your Canadian colleagues.
Yeah.
I think there's the analytical contribution, and we provide our analytical economic view to finance ministers across Canada and federally, and the challenge is then small deficits turn into deficits for as far as the eye can see, I think I'm quoting somebody correctly, and then also the definition of what infrastructure spending broadens out, and when you look at the real dollars spent, which most economists would argue you could see return on that helps productivity. It's just the definition of what gets included in infrastructure sometimes get much wider than what we would suggest.
This is where the issue of governance is so important.
Yeah. Yes, fair point.
And if you don't get the governance right, then it undermines community confidence in the government's doing this, because the people get suspicious that everything gets called infrastructure and then gets financed on debt. So, our world faces a lot of problems. Doing good governance on infrastructure isn't one of those really great problems our world faces. It's a political problem. It's solvable. We're an intelligent, capable country. We should be able to solve that.
I think we have time for one more question. Please.
Dr. Lowe, Michael Heath from Bloomberg News. I just wanted to ask you about global reflation. I know you've mentioned that the increase in the oil price is part of that, and other people talk of Donald Trump and the hopes of infrastructure and tax plans there. I just wanted to put to you, how important is the reemergence of PPI out of China after 4 years of declines? They seem to correspond quite a lot with the problems we've had and the more optimism we have now. Just wondering your view on that.
Yeah, well, the rise in Chinese producer price inflation is really reflecting the higher commodity prices that you alluded to. This is good news. It's a reflection that the global economy is a bit stronger, the demand for commodities is stronger, industrial production is picking up, and that's helping reflate our economies. I don't see a very high risk of this turning into a big bout of inflation anywhere around the world. And as wage growth, as we were talking about before, wage growth is very weak, or is quite weak, almost everywhere. And we're not going to have an inflation problem unless wage growth picks up very substantially. And I don't see many countries around the world where wage growth is accelerating. In some countries, the US, it's kind of picking up gradually. I don't know about in Canada, but it seems a long way away from the day where wage growth is accelerating to uncomfortable levels. So it's good news that commodity prices have picked up. That will help stop the kind of any talk of deflation, hopefully any further talk of global monetary easing. So I think it's good news. It's not, you know, it's not something we should be worried about.
All right, so with that time, Governor, you have one short, last one.
Sorry,
please.
Thank you, Governor. Carrington Clark from the ABC. I'm just interested in your comments on household indebtedness. Australia last year overtook Switzerland as the highest rate of household debt to GDP ratio, picking over 125%. Is that level, the current level of indebtedness, household indebtedness in Australia, unsustainable? How worrying is it to you, and what can be done to target it?
I don't think it's unsustainable. The ratio of household debt to income, it's a little higher than the range that it's been at since the early 2000s. So if it's unsustainable, it's been unsustainable for more than a decade. So it's high. It raises a vulnerability, though, because many households are finding that their debt levels are not declining as quickly as they'd previously hoped that they would, because wage growth is slow and it's taking longer to pay off the debt. So the concern or the risk that we focus on is at some future point, households might decide, well, they've just borrowed too much, and then they, in response to some bad piece of news, really cut back a lot. So that's the risk. It's hard to kind of put a number on that risk, but that's the risk we're trying to manage. And if household borrowing keeps rising at the current rate, or it were to accelerate, then I think that would be quite problematic, because that risk would go up. It's not something that we target. It's a consideration, though, in our deliberations about the right setting of monetary policy. Now, as I said, that we've managed with this level of debt to our income for a decade and a bit without particular problems. So I don't think it's unsustainable. It's just a risk factor.
Governor, on behalf of the delegates, thank you for a thoughtful presentation, a great discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.